big layoff announcement is expected from Sony.
Is the job picture starting to deteriorate?
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Monday, April 9th.
Coming up, we'll take a rare look at the factory where iPads are made.
We'll explore the battle between two conservative media icons.
And forget using your frequent flyer miles for free trips. How about socks?
Those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
The Sony Corporation is reportedly going to cut 10,000 jobs by the end of this year. That is a major hit, about 6% of the total workforce of the consumer electronics giant. Marketplace's Yves Tro has more.
When he took over this month, Sony CEO Kazuo Hirai promised to whip the Japanese giant into fighting condition. It hasn't turned a profit in 4 years. The job cuts, 6% of Sony's workforce, will come from selling off side businesses and likely cuts to manufacturing. Jeff Kingston at Temple University in Tokyo says huge layoffs are rare in Japan, and there's not much hope the cuts will lead to Sony's recovery.
Most people here think Sony's best days are behind it.
If Sony products aren't moving, why make so many, says Roger Kay at Endpoint Technologies.
People don't buy TVs very often, so the TV market is highly saturated, and Sony is sitting in a position where they have a lot of inventory.
He says to make money, the company must develop hit products, like its notebook computers a decade ago, and bring back the brand's reputation for innovation.
Steve Jobs at Apple used to say that he hoped that his company would someday be kind of like Sony.
A recent Nikkei survey asked Japanese consumers to name the best brand. Their favorite? Apple. I'm Yves Tro for Marketplace.
So is the Sony news an anomaly, or does it fit into a more troubling employment picture after last Friday's jobs report from the Labor Department found only about half as many jobs as expected were created last month in March? Julia Coronado is chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas. She's with us now from New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what do you think? You put these two things together, the Sony news and the jobs report from the Labor Department. It doesn't look good.
It doesn't look great. I mean, 120,000 jobs was a big disappointment. It's not a disaster, so it's not like we're tipping into recession or anything close to it. But it does throw a little bit of cold water on the notion that we were just starting to rev up and kick into full gear in the U.S.
Well, it does remind us of the last couple of years. We've had these bad marches in the last couple of years where things start to turn in the wrong direction. What's going on this time?
Yeah, it does start to feel like the movie Groundhog Day,
yeah,
where Bill Murray keeps waking up to the same day morning after morning. So, you know, sometimes we hit a weak patch. We blame it on weather, be it cold winter or this time a warm winter, or we hit a strong patch and we say the consumer is back. But if we just kind of pull away the curtains and look at the fundamentals of the recovery, it's just a tough, gradual recovery. We're moving in the right direction. We are rehiring people, but there are ebbs and flows in this process, and we are digging ourselves out of a pretty deep hole, so it's going to take a while.
Julia Coronado, chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas, thanks as always.
It's a pleasure.
Well, after that jobs report on Friday, a big question is whether the weak number will persuade the Federal Reserve that more stimulus is needed. And we may get some clues about that when Chairman Ben Bernanke speaks in Atlanta this morning.
Another question is whether corporate earnings will show the same weakness as the employment report. And tomorrow, we'll get the first read on corporate profits for the latest quarter from the aluminum company Alcoa. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Compared to a year ago, analysts are estimating corporate profits have held virtually flat. So why was the S&P 500 index up 12% in the first 3 months of the year?
The market obviously was well ahead of itself.
Mike Mullaney at Boston's Fiduciary Trust thinks investors got overly optimistic, even as rising energy prices and economic troubles overseas ate into profits. Christine Short is senior manager at S&P Global Markets Intelligence. She says the double-digit profit growth seen last year was bound to be a tough act to follow.
We were up almost 20%, and that was on top of 56% growth in 2010.
Short hopes the gloomy outlook among analysts might actually create some upside surprises, but portfolio manager Mike Mullaney sees caution signs ahead.
The prospect of positive surprises and positive earnings per share growth in general above expectations is waning at the very minimum.
Analysts say there could be a return to double-digit profit growth by the end of the year if energy prices ease and there's a clear solution to Europe's debt crisis. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
So, Jeremy, in March, that jobs report, we had that strange anomaly where the number of jobs created in the month was disappointing, but the unemployment rate from the survey of households actually seemed to get better, which was a good surprise.
That's right. And the reason for that, David, is that 164,000 fewer people told the Labor Department they were out actively looking for work. Here to talk with us about that is Matt O'Brien, an associate editor at The Atlantic. Hi, Matt.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. Should we be worried by that drop, or is that okay if people are leaving the labor force?
Well, it's not good news, but it's maybe not quite as bad news as it looked like. If you look deeper into the numbers, you see that of those people who were outside the labor force, people we talk about as discouraged workers, 79,000 fewer of them said they actually wanted a job right now.
Hmm.
And it can be pretty difficult to tell whether people who aren't looking for a job aren't looking for one because they're too discouraged or because maybe they went to grad school or maybe they retired.
So there's a possibility that people are leaving the workforce for reasons that are not terrible.
Right. Now, there was a study from Barclays that showed that of the people who are outside the labor force and say they do not want a job right now, over half of them are people 55 years and older. And so if you look at the data for the last couple months, we peaked in basically mid-2011 in terms of people who were outside the labor force but wanted a job. But in the last couple of months, it's fallen pretty sharply. And there's reason to think that that is people who, you know, are on the cusp of retirement and they're deciding to retire a little bit earlier than they planned on.
So these are boomers that are getting out of the labor force.
Right. CBO always knew that the participation rate, you know, the percent of people who were looking for jobs was going to fall as the boomers retired. So this isn't something that, you know, should terrify us too much. It's not good news, but it's not quite as bad.
It's a little hard, Matt, to swallow the notion, though, that suddenly everybody cashed in their 401ks and were rich enough to go off into retirement or had made a killing in the real estate market and are doing the same. I mean, you need the money if you're going to retire a little early, right?
That's true. You know, there are a lot of possibilities. It's hard to tell from the data so far, but, you know, maybe their spouse is working. You know, markets are near their 2007 highs. You know, maybe their 401k is doing better than they had feared a couple of years ago. And, you know, if you're an older worker, it's harder to learn new skills if you can't get a job with your old skills. And so if you've been out of the labor force for a couple of years, you might say, you know, I can't see a future and decide to retire.
Now, do you see those numbers in the actual Labor Department numbers, or is it just coming from that Barclays report that says that it's boomers that are getting out of the workforce?
Well, it's mostly the Barclays report, but if you look again at the numbers from the Labor Department, it shows that they ask people who are not looking for work, do you want to work? And of all the people who aren't looking for work, that's fallen. You know, we had this huge jump in 2008, 2009 of people who weren't working, who weren't looking for work, who wanted work. Then it came down a little bit, and then it went up again in 2011. And then, you know, basically from the end of 2011 till now, it's come down fairly sharply, and that continued in March.
Matt, you've got the data here, and anecdotally, I just talked to an old friend in California, definitely baby boomer age, looked for work for several years, couldn't find anything, and just the other day to me, he said the magic word. He said, I'm in retirement now. This is a guy in his late 50s. It surprised me, but it's possible that's the sort of story that you're uncovering.
Exactly. You know, it's not good news, but it's not quite as bad as, say, people who are prime working age dropping out of the labor force. You know, we're looking for the silver lining here. We would want more people working. But what seems to be happening is the Great Recession is pushing forward people's plans to retire. Things that, you know, this was always going to happen, that the boomers were going to retire. The question is, are they going to do it now or are they going to do it in 2015? And, you know, for increasing numbers, they're doing it now.
Maybe it's more of a gray lining than a silver lining, Matt. Matt O'Brien, associate editor at The Atlantic. Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Now we're going to go to where your iPhone or iPad is made. Foxconn, the Chinese manufacturer that makes 40% of the world's electronics, including many Apple products. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz was recently granted access to an Apple production line at a Foxconn factory. He is only the second journalist ever to do that, and he joins us now. Hi, Rob.
Hey, Jeremy.
So what's it like in there?
Well, I think, you know, I've been to other factories before, and you see usually at factories like a lot of machines and workers here and there. But in this factory, on the iPad assembly line, what first hits you is just the sheer amount of people. I mean, you see line after line of hundreds of workers, and you get this realization that this is a real manual labor process for what is a machine that's very sleek and looks like a machine actually made it. But in fact, every single part of that is being put together by a person.
Now, one of the things that just happened in the last couple of weeks is that Foxconn agreed to reduce the overtime hours for its workers. What are the workers telling you about this?
So last week, Apple and Foxconn gave me this guided tour of Foxconn's largest factory in China in the city of Shenzhen across the border from Hong Kong. But prior to that tour, I spent a couple of days talking to workers outside the gates of that factory. Neither Foxconn nor Apple knew I was doing this. And I asked the workers what less overtime would mean for them. Now, keep in mind that 99% of the workforce at the Shenzhen factory are migrant workers. They came to Shenzhen from hundreds of miles away to work here. And they came here specifically to work a lot of overtime. So many of the responses I got were like this one from a worker named Xu. So he's saying that he'll probably return to his home village soon. He's realized that he can't save enough money living in a developed coastal city like Shenzhen. The cost of living is just too high.
So without the overtime, he's just not making enough money. Well, if these villagers are going to go back to their homes, what does that mean for the manufacturers like Foxconn?
Well, I asked Foxconn spokesman Louis Wu about this, and one of the things that Foxconn's already doing is that they're replacing workers with machines. For example, on the iPad assembly line I toured, you know, I was just talking about all the people on that line, but part of the line, a very small part that assembles the motherboard to the iPad, was now being done by a 20-foot-long machine. I asked one of the engineers what impact that had on Foxconn's workforce, and he told me that the machine replaced about 1/7, about 28 workers on that particular line. That's 1/7 of the line. And there are other ways that Foxconn is changing. Louis Wu and I talked about how this new generation of workers in China are different from their parents. And here's Louis.
The new generation of workers, they don't like to engage in this line of business as much as before. Right. So in a sense, is that you can argue, you know, China is changing, the worker is changing, and so is Foxconn.
So if the work is changing and Foxconn is changing, does that mean that assembly line work in China is going to be a thing of the past?
I think what it means is less assembly line work in developed parts of China like Shenzhen is going to happen. I mean, instead of workers migrating 1,000 miles to the Chinese coast, now what we may start seeing are companies moving their factories away from the coast to where the workers actually come from. So instead of the workers migrating, it'll be the factories. And Foxconn's already doing this. The company's newest factories are all in inland provinces. And in some ways, this is a win-win. Foxconn saves money on wages because wages in China's interior are lower than on the coast. And the workers can be closer to their families.
Marketplace's China correspondent Rob Schmitz in Shanghai. His series, The People Behind Your iPad, will be airing this week on Marketplace. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks, Jeremy.
China is also tending to its garden of earthly delights amid criticism from the U.S. and EU over its quotas for exporting rare earths. China is setting up a new association to streamline the industry. Rare earths are essential to most electronic gadgets, and most of the world's supply is mined in China. Joining us for some context is Michael Komisaroff, an Australia-based consultant on rare earths. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Tell me, why have the Chinese decided to create this new body now?
For a number of years now, the Chinese have tried to consolidate the industry, and they've not had much success. And by forming an industry association, that's the first step in trying to bring the consolidation, which they've tried for a number of years but failed.
Now, the environmental angle here, we have to explain, is that mining rare earths can be a dirty business.
The mining and the initial processing of them involves some very dangerous chemicals, which leave a lot of waste. And in China, these mines have been operating for many, many years and have built up waste heaps or tailings dams of very polluted, contaminated waste.
I have to ask you, though, is there
Yes.
really a shortage of this stuff?
I don't believe there's a shortage. The Chinese have tried to impose restrictions, but the material gets out. I think there's an air of uncertainty that's causing people to worry. But like anything that's in short supply, the market will respond. China has over 90% of the market, but it has less than 40% of the reserve base. And others are now starting to develop their industries and bring them online.
Michael Komisaroff is founder of the Australia-based consultancy Urandaline that works predominantly in this area of China rare earths. Michael, thank you.
My pleasure.
Rush Limbaugh gets new competition on the radio today. Former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee will debut his own syndicated radio show with a conservative bent right in Limbaugh's same weekday time slot. Limbaugh has been losing advertisers. Marketplace's John Dimsdale has our story.
The slogan for the Huckabee show is more conversation, less confrontation. Doesn't sound like what usually sells on talk radio stations.
Since Rush stepped in it, the specter of Huckabee replacing Limbaugh on some of those stations has become a topic of extreme interest in the radio community.
Holland Cook is a talk radio consultant. Ever since Limbaugh called a college law student a slut for supporting contraception insurance, the number of stations signing up for the launch of Huckabee's show has more than doubled. Cook thinks Limbaugh's shock jock language is losing its appeal.
Maybe there's a generational quality to this. When you listen to him, it sounds like a bit of a vestige. He seems to pine for the Gipper, who was elected nearly 30 years ago, and that was then and this is now.
Audiences have been abandoning Limbaugh over the past 3 years, and to keep his base of older white men tuned in, he's resorted to a more inflammatory style, says David Frum, a conservative commentator for the Daily Beast.
So it's been happening to the radio audience. It's like leaving a glass of orange juice out on the windowsill on a hot day. The volume of fluid shrinks, and the flavor becomes much more concentrated.
Frum says Huckabee's softer style will appeal to women who've been deserting Limbaugh's show.
And if you bring women into your listenership, women are bigger consumers than men, and advertisers are very, very interested in talking to a more female-tilted audience.
If Limbaugh continues to alienate women, Frum says he may end up alongside another shock jock, Howard Stern, on satellite radio. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The other day I was writing a story with a reference to looking something up using my personal tablet computer. My what? I didn't want to needlessly mention the brand name of the iPad. Now the Associated Press reports that iPad is becoming the generic term for all devices of its ilk. While Apple will no doubt ruthlessly protect its trademark, the article includes a list of brands that did get so generic they entered the language as common nouns. Turns out Zipper used to be a B.F. Goodrich brand, Escalator belonged to Otis Elevator, and until 1921, the pharmaceutical giant Bayer owned the brand heroin. There are these tidy, medium-sized grocery stores in places like Arizona, Nevada, and California, but Britain's biggest grocery chain has now been told to ditch its fresh and easy stores in the United States. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
With around a third of Britain's supermarket business, Tesco has hit the ceiling here, and so it's looked for growth abroad, in the US and elsewhere. Over the past 5 years, it launched more than 180 supermarkets in California, Nevada, and Arizona. The ultimate goal was a national chain under the banner Fresh and Easy. But the ventures proved anything but. Earnings shriveled like an old lettuce. Competition stiffened. Losses have topped more than $1 billion. Two of Tesco's biggest investors have now called on the company to pull out of the US. Fund manager Justin Urquhart-Stewart says Tesco should never have crossed the pond.
I can't actually remember one British grocery or supermarket firm that's actually succeeded in the United States. And frankly, in that style of business, we've never done terribly well ever since they started throwing our tea in the harbour.
Tesco is now under pressure to come home and focus all its energies on the UK business, which is profitable but flagging. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Well, if you had an Easter or Passover feast over the weekend, it's probably a little early to think about Thanksgiving. But that is exactly what Kraft Foods, the makers of stovetop stuffing, want to do with a new ad campaign that launches today. Sally Herships reports.
One of Stovetop's new ads shows an angry teenage pilgrim with a strong opinion about stuffing.
If something tastes good, you should be able to eat it whenever. And what's with all this turkey? Why not Stovetop with pork chops or tacos?
Melissa Abbott is with consumer research firm The Hartman Group. She says stuffing is associated with winter and holidays. Even if Stovetop spends more on ads, consumers may not buy more.
We would love it less if we had it on everyday occasions.
Hidden Valley is also trying a rebrand. It's thickened its ranch salad dressing and is selling it as the new ketchup. Tim Calkins teaches marketing at Kellogg School of Management. He says the move could be risky.
You've got to find a way to, you know, remind people about the salads, but at the same time, get them thinking about hot dogs.
Calkins says getting consumers to use old products in new ways has worked well for some brands. Classic example, Arm & Hammer baking soda.
My personal favorite is we're supposed to, I guess, pour it down the drain.
From a brand's perspective, it doesn't get better than that. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
And finally, David, the airlines of the world have some new ideas for you to use your frequent flyer miles on. Forget free trips or upgrades. Those are so last year. Now, according to the LA Times, with 21,000 points on the German carrier Lufthansa, you can get three pairs of socks delivered to you three times a year.
Wow. Yeah. It just comes in the mail. That's perfect.
Right. That's great use of your miles. Or on Air Baltic, the Latvian national airline, they'll give you a dog sled adventure for 13,754 miles. Though, you'll probably have to pay a baggage fee if you want to bring your own dog sled along on that adventure. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.